Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A surprising number of websites are collecting some or all of the data you type into a digital form as you type it, even before you submit it, and it's snatching everything from your email address to password information, according to new research that analyzed websites in Europe and the U.S. Lily Hay Newman is a senior writer at Wired. She's been covering the issue. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I guess I shouldn't be surprised by this because of the way spell check works, right? I mean, something can be grabbed and and assumed assumptions can be made in split seconds.
Yeah, it's true. But I think it still really subverts user expectations of how these forms work because there's a big submit button right there. So you're thinking that pressing that button is going to do something.
So when I start to maybe buy something on a website, but then change my mind, they already can actually see at least that I was interested.
Right, exactly. And I think another big example that was coming up in this research is signing up for newsletters or, you know, some type of email that would come regularly. And, you know, maybe you type in your email address or you type in most of it. But then you think, I don't actually really want this mailer, and you X out. But then you start getting the newsletter. You know, that's the type of scenario we're talking about.
How are they doing it? Is it legal what they're doing?
Yes, it is legal. And it's using sort of the same technology that's used in a malware context or like a hacking context. It's called a keylogger. And, you know, you're just looking at what is being typed into the form in real time. So, you know, when you've used hacking techniques and malware to gain access to someone's entire phone and you're keylogging everything they're doing, you know, that's improper access that's not expected. On someone's website, you know, if you visit someone's website, you know, the same concept applies that you're not expecting it and you wouldn't think it, especially when there's a submit button right there. But, you know, it is possible that the website is set up so that, you know, each thing you type is automatically immediately being logged.
Including credit card numbers.
Yeah, it could be.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about how websites are collecting some or all of the data you type into a digital form. And when I say digital form, we've done it a million times where you're thinking about buying something, thinking about signing up for something, and then you change your mind. You don't submit it. But guess what? The info goes through anyways. My guest is Lily Hay Newman. She's a senior reporter at Wired, and we're talking about new research that analyzed websites in Europe and the U.S. in this regard. Lily, are there any particular offenders of this, or is it across the board?
Well, the research was looking at, you know, the top 100,000 websites. So, you know, these are popular sites, the things that everybody goes to. And one interesting thing about the findings was they found a difference between how often this behavior cropped up with users accessing the sites from the European Union versus the United States. And they were finding that there were more examples of the behavior when folks were accessing sites from the United States. The researchers theorized that perhaps this has something to do with, you know, Europe's GDPR data protection laws, and, you know, that maybe the sites are more cognizant of how many third parties, you know, and how many trackers they have on their sites for those audiences. But they are, you know, emphasizing that that's just a theory. That's not, you know, what they were researching specifically.
I was kind of surprised. I thought that those regulations would protect people in Europe.
Well, one finding that the researchers did have is that a lot of times sites, their thought is that sites didn't necessarily know they were even doing this, and that it came from, you know, third-party modules, things like, you know, ad modules to serve ads to users, things like that, and that it wasn't necessarily, you know, in the intended design of the site by the first-party creator. So, you know, that might contribute to part of why it was cropping up at all, you know, much less on sites for European audiences.
How are third parties getting access? How does that work?
So, you know, third parties can be given access to do like cross-site tracking of users to try to figure out okay, if you were looking at this product on this site, and we can use cookies to see that your same browser looked at a different product on a different site, we can start to get a sense of maybe you have a garden, maybe you have a boat, that type of sort of tracking that follows us across the web. You need to grant that type of access to the third party. So again, we wouldn't specifically think of it as hoovering up data in a form before we submit it, but that access could be there.
How did they conduct the research? How did they figure this out?
These researchers have done similar types of work where they're, using crawlers to crawl through sites and see how they're built, which is publicly accessible information. It's they're doing analysis that, in its simplest form, like you could do on your own web browser.
I'm
maybe
shaking
not
my head,
us,
everybody.
but we're glad they're doing it for us. But just to make the point that they're not hacking into anyone's systems, they're not hacking into networks. This is through analysis of the websites as they are presented in the browser, and I think they were not, I think they told me they were very surprised by what they found too. They didn't expect there to be almost 3,000, sites that they saw doing this for US audiences. It's definitely a shocking finding.
And so when we talk about the nearly 3,000 websites logged into a US user's email in some form, is that a function of cookies?
I think it's just sort of like a potentially like relate in a related area. It's not exactly a function of cookies, but it's, if a website, either again, the first party that builds the website or a third party that has access to the data that's flowing through that site, they could elect to just start gathering this data as you're typing. Again, it's not that it, I think it, you start to see like, oh, it could be technically feasible. It's not like a whole other thing you have to build. It just feels odd because the whole purpose of having a submit button is to say, I get my form ready and then I submit. And even if I have a typo in my email address four times, you wouldn't think that all of that could be getting caught. You're thinking the point is to set up everything correctly before you submit it.
The research found 52 websites in which third parties, including the Russian tech giant Yandex, were collecting passwords, particularly. Why?
So, again, it could just be that it was part of like broader, key logging that was going on in the form, like they wanted to get the email address, things like that. It could be to start sort of the process of vetting the password early. Could be for something like when someone's setting up an account, they want to be able to like autofill the password that you put in, even if you lose the page and you lose your internet connection or something. But regardless, I think you're correctly highlighting that that's an incredibly creepy behavior and kind of undermines how passwords should be securely stored and what the flow should be. You shouldn't, websites should not be storing plain text of exactly the letters and symbols and numbers you typed in. As you're doing it, they should be storing a hashed version, a cryptographically protected version after you submit it, so they can't be stolen. So that, was a particularly egregious finding. And the researchers actually were reporting this to as many sites as they could. And they say that all of those instances of password collection have now been resolved.
Were there any examples of nefarious motivations in all of this, or they weren't able to just ascertain that?
Yeah, I don't think that the researchers were really able to determine motivations. I think the password collection was just the most important one to make sure that, they had reported it and got it fixed in as many instances as possible, which I believe they were able to get it fixed in all instances. But I don't think they were able to say the motivations. And again, there is this question of, do many of these sites even know that this is happening? Did they intend for this at all, or is it just sort of a function of the third party ad market and the ways the cross site tracking are done.
Meta and the parent of Facebook and TikTok both were involved in this. What did they discover about them? I should say
This was
Metapixel and TikTok Pixel, yeah.
correct, exactly. This was an additional finding after the researchers submitted their sort of like research, for review for a paper. Then they continued just sort of looking at this, and they found that, there are these little invisible pixels that websites intentionally choose to embed on their pages that enable this cross-site tracking that I'm talking about. So, the Meta Pixel, formerly known as the Facebook Pixel, it's on a ton of websites, and so that's allowing Meta to gather, it to sort of be the third party that's gathering information from their own sites, plus all these other sites where the pixel is deployed to, track users across multiple parts of the internet beyond their own gates, and see what users are doing, and again, things like, do you have a garden? Do you own a tractor? Do you know to try to do targeted advertising? And the finding here was that the pixel was seemingly enabling this same type of collection on forms before submission. The researchers even found that the Meta documentation had seemed to say that that's not what the pixel did, and that it was collecting data after a form was submitted. But the researchers submitted like a bug report about this, or a finding to Meta, that they're concerned about this. And perhaps coincidentally, or perhaps not coincidentally, Meta has removed the documentation that explained this aspect of how the pixel works. So they did not comment for my story, and neither did TikTok. But the researchers have, demos from the public internet that show this behavior in action.
And how did they respond to you in your work, writing about it?
How did the companies respond
Yeah.
to my story? They did not comment.
Going forward, I mean, is there a sense, at least in Europe, where they may consider regulating this or fines or something? In the US, they're so far behind the eight ball at this point. I don't know how they catch up, but at least in the EU.
I don't know specifically like what the mechanism could be, but I think the researchers were just really wanting to raise awareness in general that this concept exists, both to potentially shed light for regulators in different countries who might be interested, or if the public is upset about this or concerned about this, to generate sort of some outcry, or just understanding that this is going on. But I think, they were somewhat successful. I mean, it was a lot of notification to do, but a lot of the sites said, oh, we didn't realize this was going on, and they, voluntarily shut it down. So that's not, the cure to everything. Like, that's not going to stop it from happening completely. But, I think the researchers were heartened that raising awareness about this did produce some impact.
Lily Hay-Newman, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, good to be here.
Lily Hay-Newman is a senior reporter at Wired. We'll have a link to her piece. It's titled Thousands of Popular Websites See What You Type Before You Hit Submit. We'll have that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Demand for diverse technology talent in Central Ohio is growing, but the supply has not kept pace. The City of Columbus, in response, has approved a $400,000 grant for a startup computer coding school on the Near East Side that focuses its courses on educating Black and Brown workers for careers in technology. Color Coded Labs started a year ago. Doug McCullough is co-founder and CEO of Color Coded Labs and co-founder of Black Tech Columbus. Welcome back, Doug McCullough.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah, you know, we talked a year ago. There was a demand then. What have you learned in the year since about the challenges?
So it's interesting. The demand is ongoing. It's ever growing. And what we have learned is that this is an economic shift. It's not a short-term problem. It is a change in how work will be staffed going forward. And the digital divide informs this as well. And so the more people who don't have access to certain digital skills, the less prepared they will be for this new workforce of the future. But the big lesson that we've learned is that the hardest part of this is helping people understand the new opportunities that are available to them if they have the skills, and the risk that we all have to take to develop new skills and move into a new pathway that a lot of people have not been prepared to take.
Right, because of the digital divide. I mean, it's fine to say that they're teaching something in school, but if you're going home and there's a dearth of technology...
Well, there's a lot of people who might look at this as being even an astronaut. It's just out of range for people. They don't understand what do you mean by technology. And what the images we see on television or in media about what technology is and what kind of people thrive in that career field, it just doesn't seem accessible to a lot of people. I would even say most people. But when you look at underrepresented and underserved and marginalized communities, it's even more out of range or apparently out of range. And that's one of the big challenges we have to overcome.
How do you recruit?
Well, we actually find going directly to people, being present in the places where the populations we're targeting may be. So, for example, last year we did the African-American Male Wellness Walk.
Okay.
Summer 614 concert series. Places where people are going to be not in a context of learning, career change, or technology, where we can meet them and have them meet real technologists and have them ask questions and things like that. We also recruit with the Ohio Means Jobs Center. They have some virtual hiring fairs, and there are a number of virtual hiring fairs that we can be present at to let people know, hey, you may not be eligible for this job today, but in a few months you could be. But we have to meet people face-to-face and in-person.
Okay, that's the thing. Going online isn't necessarily where you're going to find them.
Well, people go online and they research us, but they don't sign up until they've had an opportunity to ask some questions. So having some videos and a good website is great, but it's not a decision point.
How much of what you do revolves around just recruiting and finding the students to fill the classrooms?
A significant amount. Finding them is certainly a challenge. However, word of mouth helps. Graduates go out there in the world and they say, hey, I just did this thing. You should do it too. But then running a cohort, actually, when you have people in a room or online learning and you're introducing them places and you're responsible for their success. So that is a significant amount of time. When someone else is learning, we are there with them, learning along with them. So, you know, we're not just setting people on a path and leaving them alone. We're responsible for them succeeding in the program. So that takes up a lot of time.
So tell us about, give us some examples. I'll be the recruit here. What do you mean technology and how does it affect me and what would I do?
Well, we focus on what we call full stack software development using JavaScript, and then we break that down.
So they're coding.
They're coding. They are writing software code. They are eligible to become a software developer or a software development engineer at a junior level. And what that means is they're learning a new software language, how to write code in a way that would manifest as a software product, such as an app on a phone or a website or a web application. that they might normally use. TikTok is a web app. You know, Meta, Facebook is a web app. And we show how the code that they would learn to write would allow them to do that. But we also talk to them about that being a foundational technology skill that could lead them to other technology roles, such as in cybersecurity or data analytics or something else like that.
Where would I work?
So the city of Columbus alone, first of all, you could work anywhere in the world, but the city of Columbus alone has in all sorts of companies software development roles, including companies you wouldn't think of as a tech company, such as JP Morgan Chase or Nationwide or any insurance company. Universities hire technology staff like this. The state of Ohio, cities hire that. But the big hirers are going to be in Accenture or OCLC.
The big library.
The big library thing up in Dublin. Startups and new companies like Root Insurance, Beam Dental, Lower.com, Aware, consulting type companies, they all hire for the same set of foundational tech skills. And everyone is building software.
And then they'll train you. I mean, they need you to have that foundation, and then you move on from there.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting is when you get into one of these roles, they do train you. They continue training you. It's not the end of your training journey. It's just the beginning.
So there's, you know, let's talk about the diversity piece of this and what the challenges are there.
Yeah, so these companies have thousands of roles at what most of us would consider very high salaries. And people are very successful in this career field. They are building wealth, what we would consider to be wealth. They own homes. They own cars. Their children are going to college. And they are suffering for a lack of diversity. Not having a diverse tech workforce that a company can draw upon or a pool that they can draw upon means that they are less competitive than their peers or their competitors who do have a diverse tech workforce. And I must say, one of the things these companies have to do is be creative, they have to solve problems creatively. If you do not have diversity in your workforce, you don't have that creative friction, those diverse backgrounds, neurodiversity that allow teams to actually come up with better solutions to business problems.
Right. Having people from all different walks of life is good for problem solving.
It's actually critical, I think, and companies are learning that this is not just the right thing to do. It helps you meet business objectives.
And so you get somebody interested in this. They think they have the acumen, but how would they even know? I've never taken a computer programming class before. I think I did Minecraft and thought, whoa. But, you know, there's an impetus if you want to make a living at it. But how do you find people and how do you measure their acumen for something like this, if this is something good for them?
Yeah, well, we do have people do an assessment. There are three stages to getting into the program. One is filling out an application, and that's a pretty big step because it means you're interested and it means you can follow through on something, and that's required. But then we have them take an assessment, which is more cognitive. It's not math. It's not programming. But it is helping people, helping the program understand if you have the capacity to follow certain logic instructions to solve simple problems. If you can do those things, then you get an interview, and then we discuss other things about your career goals and can you actually do the program. There's a big time commitment. And from there, you can succeed in the program. We know from the assessment whether or not you can do it.
Is high school graduation a requirement?
We target what we call gritty working adults.
Okay.
But really what we need is every graduate from the program needs to be able to begin working. If you're a senior in high school, you could do that. But we want to make sure that, you know, these skills are fresh and hot and you need to use them immediately. We don't want people to come into the program and in only 2 or 3 years later they're working, because we're talking about earnings. We're getting people to earn new money and raise their incomes by significant amounts. So if you're in high school and you cannot work like that, then you couldn't take advantage of the program. However, we do want people who are in high school going through this program and getting those jobs. We just want to make sure that we are not interrupting what could otherwise be a college pathway or a military pathway. But it is a viable option for people.
What do you mean by gritty working adults?
Well, you know, the industry wants people who are available, but they don't have certain skills. So most people who are going into a new career field, actually most people are working. They're hustling, maybe. Mm-hmm. They may be working as a driver or having two or three jobs. These are the kinds of people who have what it takes to make it in technology. They just don't know it. And we say gritty because people have suffered setbacks. They've been challenged with life situations, and they have overcome them. These are the kinds of characteristics that companies want. And so we try to attract them.
What about new Americans, immigrants?
Absolutely. Our current cohort has a few, and we are actively working on that particular community, again, because of underrepresentation in the technology industry and an availability of an enormous amount of talent who are not going to approach something unless they have a certain amount of trust where that's concerned. But we are definitely targeting those communities.
I remember a long time ago I was writing about kind of the poorest school district in the state, and it was getting a new school building, a new high school, right, because of the bond issue that was passed years ago. You know, the school buildings are all modern, but they had a computer room, but they had no computers in it because that was more of a soft expenditure and it wasn't considered a capital expense. And, you know, you have to wonder, schools have varying degrees and varying levels of tech education ability. Does that matter?
It most definitely matters, and that can't be anymore. We look back on those times of empty computer rooms. Mm-hmm. That cannot be. Not in Ohio, not in America. We need significant investment in our K-12 system, and not only do we need the hardware in there, but we need the curricula, we need the teacher training. There's just an enormous amount of activity that really needs to take place there for the long term. Again, this is an economic shift, and we need people coming out of high school prepared to go into college programs, non-college programs, boot camps, and at this point, they are not as prepared. We need to do that while not harming math, arts, sports, or those kinds of things. We can't just add computer science in, but it definitely has to be a significant and integral part of the K-12 experience.
Can you tell us a success story from, it's been a year now, can you tell us about somebody who made the leap? Against all odds, in their own mind, have achieved.
I will tell you a success story of April Cunningham. She was living in Florida when she applied for the program. She began the program going through it. She wound up having a feeding frenzy of companies wanting to hire her by the time she ended the program. And she landed a role north of $80,000 a year, significant income boost. And she returned to Ohio. And so she came back to Columbus. And that's a big deal to us because we believe that we can stop some of the brain drain. We export talent in Ohio. We train them, we prepare them, we have them, and they leave. When Ohio has become the attractive place where you can have a great cost of living and a great career and live better, that's a great success story.
And she loves it?
She absolutely loves it. She returns back to our cohorts to talk to other people about what she has experienced, and it's just been a wonderful experience watching her grow, and we have other stories like that as well.
Tell me about the impact of having Intel come here.
So the Intel arrival is really a poster child for a lot of arrivals that have been happening. Intel coming kind of drowned out the fact that Amgen was coming, mm-hmm. and that we have major facilities in the same area with Meta, with Google, with Amazon. But Intel has the heft, and they're talking about chip making, which is a level of technology that the United States is suffering from, not having invested there. Right. We have to, as a country, invest in that. And Ohio managed to land one of these chip makers. So they bring with them pressure to reform and implement things in your K-12 system and steer your workforce more towards tech. And they have the jobs to back it up. So their arrival is just a really breath of fresh air, and it's really great. I met some of the Intel executives yesterday, and one of the things that they are being told is, welcome, but you're not alone, right? People are going to fight with you over this talent. So come on in, welcome to the fight, and welcome to Columbus.
Tell me a little bit about color-coded labs, you know, how many students you have, what you want to scale up to, what your goals are, and how you spend that $400,000 from the city.
Sure. So our current cohort is 18 people, which we're very happy about, a great deal of diversity on many levels with that group. A normal cohort for us going forward would be maybe 20, up to 25, but that's a pretty big cohort, and we have to break it into smaller pieces. We'd like to get 100 or 150 people moving through color-coded labs every year. And the money from the city goes towards a significant amount of capacity for us and towards curriculum. And so we want to expand beyond just full-stack software development using JavaScript, but owning the curriculum to do that, and we'd like to get into software sales and cybersecurity, data and analytics, UI, UX, the user interface and user experience training. All of those areas are hiring significantly for tech talent, and none of them require a college degree. So we want to do that, and that curriculum development costs money. But there's also us as people. Managing a cohort of 18 is a heavy lift. There's a lot of communicating, and there's a lot of introductions into the industry so that people are getting placed into jobs. We're not just training people and releasing them out on the street. We are walking them we're introducing them to the CIOs and the HR managers, and that requires more people. So capacity development is something that the city's grant allows us to do.
And when I enroll in color-coded labs, what's my responsibility financially?
So it's a boot camp, and it is not free, and it's a for-profit enterprise, and the cost of the program is $13,500. There's a significant amount of scholarship and financial assistance available, and both the county and the state of Ohio have financial assistance for people who are working below the poverty line currently or who are eligible for almost any of the federal benefits, SNAP, Medicaid, those kinds of things, are eligible for full tuition to get paid for.
It's a full-time job to go to this school.
It is a full-time job. However, because of the population we are targeting, and for other reasons, when we say gritty working adults, mm-hmm. our program meets after 5:30 in the evening. Many boot camps meet 9 to 5, which I respect. It's mm-hmm. a lot of time which need to get put in. However, if you're working a morning shift or, you cannot just, many people in black and brown communities cannot take 3 months off of work and just not earn.
Well, with child care issues and all of that.
Child care, transportation, mm-hmm. many of the people we're targeting are working two jobs. They're working weekends, and we're asking for more time. We need to put this program at a time when it is accessible to people.
And they respond.
They do respond.
Is there a waiting list?
There's not a waiting list. If we fill up a cohort, we start a cohort.
Okay, gotcha.
But again, we've got great instructors, and so the grant helps us to have instructors on call. If 15 people called us today and were eligible to start the program, we would start cohort 3. But we would need those instructors and the curriculum ready to go.
And again, somebody's listening right there and like, yeah, it sounds great. Wow, $80,000, blah, blah, blah. But I just don't think I've never really been good at computers, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. What I would caution people in is that all of our roles, all of our jobs are going to require digital skills. And we're not going to be able to avoid technology-oriented work going forward. And what we used to think of as purely manual labor, whether it is driving a truck or repairing mechanical things or manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Manufacturing is becoming advanced manufacturing. Robots are moving into the facilities, and they have to be programmed. We cannot afford to not at least explore and ask questions about career pathways. And we are one pathway. The community college system, the higher education system, there are a number of ways of doing this, but we can't stick our head in the sand and say, I just don't have those skills. Well, if you want to eat, if you want to pay your bills, you're going to have to explore and find out what would it take. And a boot camp is a great way of entering into that possibility.
And even graduating, it automatically gives you a leg up.
It does, and not just a leg up, but actually a significant boost. Not only graduating, but being introduced to 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different companies, hiring managers, developing a network. These are the things that are required to succeed in a career field, not just core skills.
Doug McCullough, thanks so much for joining us again. It's been great to catch up.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Doug McCullough is co-founder and CEO of Color Coded Labs, and he's co-founder of Black Tech Columbus. Color Coded Labs received a $400,000 grant from the city of Columbus for its startup computer coding school on the Near East Side. We'll have a link to their website at ours at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back with more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The environmental benefits of electric cars are a big selling point to many prospective buyers, but as electric cars become more common, if their old batteries aren't managed properly, they could offset many of those environmental benefits. Here to tell us how is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
What about the batteries makes them potentially harmful to the environment?
Yeah, so no matter what battery you're using, if it's the one in your phone or the one in your remote control or the giant ones that are now in cars, these are chemicals that are added to metals that are mined from the earth. And, they kind of interact with one another in order to store an electric charge. And the way that we release that electric charge, kind of maintains that chemical balance that's sitting inside of that battery. If those batteries are left in the ground when they are, kind of transmitted to waste facilities or something like that, those chemicals can and often do now, leach into the ground and poison the environment around it. And that's true of AAs and D cell batteries and things like that. So the batteries inside of your average Tesla occupy pretty much the entire length of the car. These are massive, massive batteries. And if the, it doesn't really matter what the electric vehicle is, I'm not picking on Tesla here, but if those batteries are not properly maintained when those vehicles reach end of life, then that can be disastrous at scale.
Okay, dumb question. Why do batteries wear out?
Well, so the chemical process there has an expiration date. The chemicals themselves, the chemical reaction between the mineral and the actual kind of chemical that's in there has a finite process for that chemical exchange, for the energy to be produced. And then there's a couple more kind of more complicated explanations for that depending on the kind of battery that's being used. But that is more or less the kind of the function there.
How are we currently disposing of, let's just say, our AAAs, out there? Where are they going?
Yeah, so it very much depends state by state here in the U.S. There are some states where there isn't a kind of larger battery recycling process. I know California, for example, has specific battery kind of drop-off points throughout the state where they are, if it is possible for the chemical, kind of compound inside to be repurposed into other things, then it can. But unfortunately, there are a lot of places in the U.S. where those batteries are still kind of tossed in the trash, they make it into landfills. And while a lot of landfills have appropriate lining, in fact, almost all landfills have appropriate lining that can shield from a certain amount of that, it is not a permanent solution by any means.
And we're just racking up more and more batteries all the time. And with electric cars, it's going to really up the game.
It's true. And we also see this with phones where, these are not user serviceable batteries. These aren't batteries that can be kind of popped out and replaced. But the there was a report recently from Nissan, regarding kind of on a global scale how these batteries can be processed when a vehicle is resold or being refurbished or something like that, and the battery does not meet the set of standards that are necessary in order for the battery to be useful. Nissan's proposal is that they be used in other applications. The batteries that go into cars need to operate at a very high level. They have to output a lot of energy all at once in order for the vehicle to reach certain speeds and kind of maintain that performance for certain periods of time. But there are a lot of other vehicles that are used, nationally and globally, that don't require that high level of performance. So what Nissan has done is created a rating system for its batteries. It's an A rating, a B rating, and a C rating. A rating is something that can be repurposed into another car, or another kind of high-end vehicle like that. And a B rating is something that would go into, say, a forklift, battery-powered forklift or other kind of heavy machinery like that, where the battery is still able to deliver a lot of very useful power, but it's not in something that needs to go 70 miles an hour for 3 hours at a sprint or something like that.
And work the power windows and everything else.
Correct.
I'm thinking golf carts.
Golf carts are another great example. Yeah. That's another thing for what Nissan would consider these kind of B rating and C rating batteries would be in something that isn't that kind of high demand, but is still incredibly useful to have over something that would be, the gas version of that vehicle.
Is there any regulation about how batteries are manufactured now that would, in order to render them more useful going forward?
So the United States has a series of policies for how batteries need to pass certain standards, both for kind of a construction standpoint and also like a safety in their build, being able to be punctured at certain kind of impact ratings. Is there's a whole system that goes into that, but that's not a global standard. While that's something that we have here in the U.S., it is different for different parts of the world. In some cases, better, and in some cases, not quite as stringent.
Are they trying to improve how batteries work? In other words, do they have to be these giant things that go extend the length of the car kind of a thing and make them more powerful but smaller?
Yeah, so I mean, there's always that kind of effort, right? And we look into this is no matter what the battery is. Everyone uh-huh. wants their phone to be smaller, but they also want their battery to last forever, right? Mm-hmm. So you kind of there's this dichotomy exists in almost every form of electronics that we have. And the chemical process there is always being improved by these kind of very slight margins. And when you see that kind of slight margin improve on a phone, you might see not so much the chemical process, but the kind of software that manages how that energy gets shared. That process can be improved, let's say, 1 hour at a time or something like that, where you're making these kind of small incremental gains. Those small incremental gains on something the size of a phone make a much bigger difference on something the size of a car.
You know, if they would just get us our jetpacks, we wouldn't have to worry about all this stuff.
I don't know. If we think about a battery-powered jetpack right now, that
probably
would be a really heavy jetpack. Yeah, right. that would be pretty substantial, and it would also vary a whole lot depending on kind of the build of the person. Cars are still going to be the primary mode of transportation for a lot of us for a while.
Amazon is testing a program to have drivers make deliveries from local malls. I guess
this
they might as well,
weird thing.
But like it's turning the mall into their warehouses.
So it's kind of a combination of things. Uber and Lyft, among several other delivery services, Postmates being another example, have shifted over the last couple of years to being able to pick things up from other places and bring them to you. With Postmates, you can simultaneously order something from 7-Eleven and McDonald's and the Taco Bell down the street, and they all show up as a single order. And you can do the same thing for supporting businesses in other areas. From dry cleaning to whatever it is that you would want to get from a bookstore in a mall. We do still have bookstores and malls.
Yes.
Not a lot of them, but some. And the whole, kind of gain there is, none of the stuff that gets picked up in those places are things that Amazon has any kind of data on. If you go into a mall and you buy something and you bring it home, Amazon has no idea what it is that you bought. And Amazon is not a big fan of that. So this is an effort to kind of gain more information. And if you pay close attention to the way that Amazon's business model works from selling its own products, it monitors Amazon's the kind of shopping services. And if a product is incredibly popular, Amazon tries to make a knockoff version of it. We've seen this with photography backpacks, battery packs that you put on your phones. This was something Amazon very, very early in its business did with diapers, trying to take on kind of different aspects of life and make these kind of less expensive things. But if you're shopping in a mall, Amazon has no idea what the popular thing is there. So by having this mall delivery service, Amazon's able to kind of take a peek into what stores are popular and not necessarily what products are popular, because those bags are often sealed when they're given to delivery services. But it gives Amazon this window into what places in those malls are popular in order to gain more information for what Amazon should be promoting on its own website.
Wow. I mean, like I said, it just feels like they want to turn the malls into another warehouse.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This is all about how much information Amazon can learn from your shopping habits in order to kind of own more of that pie. And, you know, while there was this great, reckoning about the death of malls when COVID lockdowns happened, you can go to a lot of malls right now and there are a ton of people still shopping, not at the same rate. Online shopping has definitely increased, but it's still online shopping is still only, depending on the time of year, between 3% and 8% of the shopping that the average person does throughout the, a given week. And that's something that Amazon is actively interested in changing.
Let's see. Corsair is a major player in desktop gaming. It's working on its first gaming laptop. Can you tell us a little bit about Corsair first? Because I hadn't heard of it before, but that doesn't mean anything.
There are lots of people who have not heard of Corsair. You are not alone there. In the world of computers that you buy for very specific purposes, Corsair has been for a little over a decade now kind of the name when it comes to very high-end gaming PCs. And this is stuff that you have all but built yourself. You go to the Corsair website and you say you want these very specific parts, and they're often very high-end parts and very expensive. And those machines that get delivered, they are they're very nice looking and they perform very well. But they very much appeal to this kind of high-end gamer PC market and not a whole lot else. They don't release a whole lot of budget machines. They're not interested in competing with Dell or Alienware or Hewlett-Packard or anything like that. They have had for a very long time that kind of very specific niche that they have existed in and been considered one of the best in that niche. But it turns out that, there is no kind of fighting the tide of people who are moving to laptops and who are, kind of gaming in different places, especially with the release of the Steam Deck, where you can play PC games on a thing that you can hold in your hands, and the popularity of the Nintendo Switch. There are a lot of people who are very happy with casual gaming where they are and not having to go to a special room to sit at a special desk in order to play a game on a special computer. And so this is what we're seeing here is one of the kind of the last big companies that focuses on just one specific kind of way that people seek entertainment, moving to a more portable form of that same entertainment.
It has a touch bar, and that's a thing. They're not calling it that, but what does a touch bar do, and why do we care?
So this is something that Apple started doing a couple years ago, where the function keys, the F keys on your keyboard on Apple laptops, they actually replaced it with a touch strip, where instead of having those function keys, you had another screen that was down by your keyboard that you would touch in order to do things. The idea was that it would make it more interactive. You could, kind of press a specific place on the screen and slide it in order to increase or decrease your volume or the brightness of your screen or something, and it would be kind of more useful. And some companies have worked with Apple in order to add extra features, but it hasn't been super well received. It hasn't been incredibly popular. And so Corsair is trying this in a different way. Instead of getting rid of the kind of function keys, they're actually adding more keys above it in the form of this digital strip that are really for gaming purposes. So if you are playing a game and you want to quickly, kind of switch weapons or, kind of activate some kind of health pack or, whatever the game would be, the idea is that you could very quickly reach up and tap that key instead of needing to have a separate accessory on the side of your laptop to do that.
Just in general, I mean, like you said, they're kind of facing the fact that laptops are a thing and joining the fray. But how do our laptops just getting better at stacking up against the desktops now?
Absolutely. So there's been a lot of effort over the last couple of years on behalf of both the PC manufacturers and the companies that make graphics cards to make laptops that are able to perform at a level that desktops have. And there have been several companies that have been very, very good at making what are, you know, thin laptops.
Russell, I'm sorry, I've lost track of time. I got to say goodbye, Russell Holly. That's the end of Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Sorry about that.